Friday, January 10th. Today began with Miss Genevieve Hendricks going through bushels of samples, and it was a rather frustrating time because it seems that all the effort I'd put in with Sally had been wasted. But we selected a number of lovely ones, and she really promises to return next week with the answers to everything. The big problem of today, and actually something that I've been looking forward to, is tea for the ladies of the press, about 65 of them, at 4 o'clock. I hope the time never comes when I feel I have to be afraid of them. As I stood in the yellow room, I was surprised to see how many of them I could call by their first names and how many of them I'm just genuinely fond of. There's Bonnie Angelo and Betty Beal and Christine Sadler Cove, McCall's Magazine, Nancy Dickerson of NBC. And when I saw Doris Fleeson come in, I almost said, if I close my eyes, Walter Lippmann will be the next one. And Helen Baldwin of the Waco newspaper had come up because she wants to write a special article on me and to see me in action is perhaps the best way to go about it. Other familiar ones, my gardening friend Isabel Griffin, Gwen Gibson, Frances Lewin and Helen Thomas, whom I feel I know best of all, Florence Lowe, and Isabel Mathis, who I guess is sort of helping out her husband, and probably the sweetest one of all, Dorothy McCardle. When I saw Sarah McClendon, I just thought, I hope I don't have to start flinching like so many people do when they see you. And that favorite of all gentlemen, Miss Marianne Means, the speaker's old friend, Hope Ridings Miller, Ruth Montgomery, who was going over to do a book on me, and he was going over to interview Lyndon on what he thought about me very shortly. Josephine Ripley, whom I remember so happily from my trip to West Virginia, and who writes for that rare newspaper that many people look to as one of the best, the Christian Science Monitor. Nan Robinson and Isabel Shelton. I think Isabel did the first byline on me that anybody ever did. And Marie Smith and Mary Van Rensselaer Thayer, and I'd a lot rather sat down and listen to her talk about the East than to listen to me talk about the White House. The purpose of the whole thing was actually to set the tenor of not having press conferences, but to invite them into a relaxed and pleasant atmosphere and to offer them somebody else who was news. This time, the person who was news was Esther Peterson, who has just been given a new job as assistant to the president on consumer problems. And the pièce de résistance was to have Esther, whom I introduced, stand up in front of the fireplace in the yellow room and tell us all about the mail she'd been receiving, about the consumer problems, about what her plans were for it. And that was the real meat of the day. Then I suggested to the ladies that perhaps they would like to have a little tour of the second floor. They all seemed quite interested in the project, so out we put. Main things I found out about it was that 65 is too many to take through on a tour, and the next time I'm going to do it with preferably 20 and possibly not more than 30. Fortunately, I've had time to do about 5 rooms pretty thoroughly with the curator, and I could do them knowledgeably, and I hope with some anecdotes. For instance, we started off in the yellow room where President Adams, the first to live in the house, used to receive in his velvet breeches with silver knee buckles and his wife Abigail seated at his side. Once a week he did it. The usual things. I can't resist being amused when I point out the porthole portrait of George Washington by Rembrandt Peale in commenting how the exceeding temerity of parents who name an infant Rembrandt, and then he turns out to be a famous painter. It was particularly a joy to point out that all the furniture in that long hall is the work of the greatest American cabinet makers in about the period 1810, in Heppelwhite and Sheraton, with their own touches added. You see, they were copying the English great of the preceding 25 or 50 years, because what with the turmoil of the Revolutionary War, we didn't catch up to doing things that were elegant and lovely until about 1795. And so this furniture was really made between then and about 1810 or 15. And it's all the result of Mrs. Kennedy's wonderful taste and determination gathering it together. Actually, one of the most interesting moments was in the Treaty Room, which was where Mrs. Franklin Delano Roosevelt used to hold her press conferences for women only. And so I asked those who had been there in those days to hold up their hands. And there were, I would say some 10 or 12 of the 64 who were gathered there, who had been there in Mrs. Roosevelt's day. And I'd rather have listened to what they had to say than what I had to say for the rest of the time. Because I've lived openly and unafraid and quite candidly, I think, with people all of my life, I found this pleasant. I like to show them my way of life. But the next morning when I read Nan Robertson's story in the New York Times, it did occur to me that I must remember to put up all books that I don't want mentioned in stories. Of course, I had been careful enough to put all letters and really private things out of sight, but it hadn't occurred to me the really fine tooth comb with which 64 or 65 newspaper women can go through the house as they simply make a quick journey. We had drinks and a happy exchange, and I enjoyed them, and I do believe it was an afternoon well spent. Then I began to see what was going to happen to my husband that night. It turned out to be one of those long, long evenings of many, many phone calls and many, many delays. I had dinner on a tray. He came home about 11:15 and had dinner and finally, at long last, to bed. I think the things they like hearing about most is the little simple personal things, like the time I walked into the Treaty Room and found Lucy Baines' algebra and Latin and some frayed notebooks and some chewed pencils sitting there on that famous table. Obviously, she'd been doing her homework there for several nights. I did think I'd better put a stop to it. It's a little bit too much of a museum for that. And I wish I'd had the nerve enough to tell them about the first night she moved in, when seeing that beautiful fire laid in the fireplace and remembering how nice it was at the brick house to go to sleep by the flames dancing up and on the ceiling. And having spend the night guest with us, she decided to light the fire. It was about 12 o'clock. Something was the matter with the draft. Smoke began to pour out through the room, presently out into the hall, and you would have thought the British were returning. I just hope she's in as good a friend with Mr. J.B. West and the rest of the servants, the rest of the staff around here after that. But I haven't quite cleared that story in my own mind for telling yet.